conversation with someone else, you can record it without telling the other person. There are other states that have different laws that require all people being recorded to be advised that they're being recorded. So, you know, the law works in mysterious ways, but I, again, as Ken mentioned, not only are there technological problems, which I'm sure are being addressed and improved, there are political ones, you know, privacy issues. And I don't think that's as simple to solve as the algorithms and the machine learning.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. It's sort of questionably ethical if somebody is being recorded without his knowledge. But the law clearly states you cannot record the voice. Or you can record the voice if the person you're talking with or the person present on your property or even outside of the property is notified and he has a full knowledge of being recorded. That regulation, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, doesn't exist for video recording. And I doubt it's going to be there because every house has a camera right now. And if we can look at NBC reports every day, somebody who is hurt, who is attacked, or is killed. So people have a full right to their own protection. Now, video recording, it's also expanded to the videographers or film recording crews or people. They do not have to ask for the permission of recording a scene, even though there are other people there. That's the law. And to exchange. Oh, please.
Well, you always seem to come on and not ID yourself, so you really should ID yourself because that's not legal as far as the FCC is concerned. But getting back to your point, Wesley, I believe that there are some limitations to that. If you record some guy and then put him in a movie without his approval, he can sue you. There are some laws that if you photograph famous people, you don't have to get their release form. But if you photograph a model or such and you sell it to a company, you have to have a release for that. Otherwise, it's not legal.
Yeah, that's a gray area. You might be right. You might be right, but so far I never heard about the one single situation that would involve a problem in this area. There are some great lawyers, and they are advisors for the security industry. Not going to mention the name in here, but they have a daily report or daily advice this for those who are licensed in the certain areas. And for the past 20 years, I didn't see one single case of a lawsuit or litigation because of that. So maybe that is coming. Maybe you're right. And to exchange.
AC2GS. Well, you know, that's the nature of law. Until someone complains, the thing is not really decided upon. It requires a complainant. They have to make a case before the court, goes up sometimes to the Supreme Court, and new interpretations of the law are instituted. Now, while we were chatting in the chat room itself, N2YTK asked an interesting question, which I don't have the faintest idea what the answer is. He says, with the Ring door, very popular, I think it was bought by Amazon, like most things are these days, but he alludes to the Ring door cams. He says, how do you think they get around the audio recording aspect? Because they're capable of recording audio, and I don't recall any signs that have to be put up for a Ring door.
For 25 years, there is a company, Japanese company, called Aphone. It has nothing to do with iPhone. It's Aphone. So those guys, they have sophisticated, not expensive, very, very inexpensive the intercoms, video intercoms with the cameras, and thousands of, hundreds of thousands, not the millions of those, are installed everywhere, on every corner. They record video and audio without the permission and without notification of the person being in front of the door. Now, that legal advisor who is advising the licensed security industry said that everything is legal because the camera is on the wall of the property of the owner. So it doesn't even have to be inside of the door. The camera is on the wall. It's physically mounted on the wall. It belongs to the wall. And the wall belongs to the owner or the somebody who is renting the apartment. Now, before, like 5-6 years ago, there was a different explanation. It was the camera is inside of the apartment, and the person is outside. So if you're not allowed to have a camera inside, then you're not allowed to have that piece of glass that you're looking at, because it's also part of the door. Now, if this this camera has a voice recording, the microphone, or it does have a vibration sensor, it doesn't matter. It's a sensor. But this sensor is using voice to record. Now, what you do with that voice, it's now nobody's business. It is your device inside of your apartment. Now, law a little bit drifted at that time, from that time. So now there is everything is going to change right now. And to actually...
Okay, but it still leaves the same question. And my gut sense is this is one of those soft, squishy parts of the law. The same way that all of these internet cameras have audio in and out. You can talk through a lot of these IP cameras. You can listen to a lot of these IP cameras. So none of that has been disabled. And my guess is eventually someday there'll be a test case that'll screw everything up. And I think that's why Ring kind of goes below the radar right now. If the time comes where for some strange reason two guys stand in front of another guy's Ring doorbell and discuss how they plan to kill someone, and then that person dies, and they use the audio as proof, it'll probably go to some court and get thrown out, and someone will want to address it with yet another privacy protection law about audio. So I think the answer to end to YTK is that it's a soft part of the law that hasn't been tested yet and hopefully never will, but could happen tomorrow.
Yeah, I think we spent so much time and people are waiting for the space report. The thing is that I absolutely agree. It must be something. It's too much. It's simply too much. The technology is getting so advanced, and people have rights to their privacy. But the question is, we have a Canon, we have a Sony, we have Panasonic. They make professional cameras. It's no longer the small camera that you had on your belt, on your pocket. Right now they have professional cameras that are small enough, but they're good enough, and you can record everything. And remember the old time, 20 years ago, you had people shooting the pictures, and nobody asked them for the permission to shoot anybody else. So if they will be trying to regulate that market, including the voice, because every camera has a voice right now, every telephone has a voice right now, then it would be a major shift to the business. It's not that it shouldn't be done. It should be done. But the question is, how would the market react to it? How would the major guys with the big man react to those kind of restriction? And to exchange.
At Y2H.
Yes, Lou.
one factor I think the law considers is something called expectation of privacy. And if you're in a public setting, you may not have an expectation of privacy. So maybe that allows these things to occur.
Well, that might be the case. I mean, thankfully, I have very little knowledge about law. You know, I have lawyers in the family, and I leave it to them. Probably you get a problem when you're, say, on a porch with a Ring doorbell. I don't know if that's private property already. So that's not quite the public property of a camera that kind of pokes its eye into the road.
Well, if I'm on someone's porch, do I have an expectation of privacy? You know, maybe not. If I'm in my house, maybe I do, because that's under my control. So it's public, but also probably, you know, it's not under your control. I don't know, but that's one consideration. But you're right, these things all have to be tested. They change, they're malleable. As you say, they vary state by state, and so on and so forth.
Okay, well, it was a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Wesley. Thank you, Lou. You know, technology gives us new tools, and it gives us new headaches because we now have to write rules on how to use those tools. And, you know, it's an ongoing thing, and I hope it continues. I would hate for us to reach some kind of peak epoch of technology, because then it's all downhill from the other side of that mountain. So thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Just want to remind everyone, if you have any email you want to send me, the email address would be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links are available for a whole bunch of really interesting YouTubes. If you want to take a look at them and discuss them at a later time, that's your option. A bunch of articles that I collected if we did a science talk this Sunday, which we didn't have an opportunity to do. So please take a look at my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. It'll be available forever and ever. So if you don't want to do it today or tomorrow, it'll be there next week, next month, and hopefully next year. I also want to remind people of Mike, KC2NJI, and his great archive site of technical nets going as far back as September 2006, and that's available at amateurradio.tv. So keep that all in mind, and now it's time for Paul, WS2N, and the SpaceNet Report.
KC2GS, WS2N. Very good. And before I start, did you see any traffic or in Brooklyn with the race? They had a Formula E race there for the last 2 days, over the weekend. It was pretty good. It was broadcast on Channel 2. So I don't know if you know anything about that, Roy.
No, I completely missed it. The closest I have to races in this area is I live two blocks away from McDonald Avenue, which is the site of the old tramway. They filled in the tram tracks only about, I guess, 20 years ago. And every so often, late at night, guys will run their car as quickly as possible. You could hear the brakes grinding away. So we have our own local version of that.
Okay, yeah, well, this would be on the other side. You know, if I was going in your direction, I'd pass the Verrazano Bridge exit, and you just keep going past the, I guess, Brooklyn Navy Yards and over to, there's a terminal there. And anyway, they took that area. You know, you know, from the scenes on TV, you could see the city. You know, you see the water. You're right on the water there, and you could see the city in the distance. But they just, I guess, boxed off this whole area for these Formula E cars. You know, Formula E is, you know, instead of Formula One, they look like Formula One cars, but they're all electric, and they really go. And of course, you wouldn't hear these things even if you're a block away, I don't think, because they're all electric. But it's an interesting sport that's starting to come around in the last few years.
good to see it was in Brooklyn. Back to you.
I missed it entirely. Probably it would strike me as not quite as fun if your car didn't go vroom, vroom when you hit the accelerator. I have a fragment of memory in the back of my head. Did they actually build something into damn Teslas that made a vroom noise when you hit the accelerator just to get around that that sensory lack?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, put baseball cards in the wheels or something. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, you could hear these things whining, you know. But I remember seeing it. They started a couple of years ago, and I think it's starting to catch on a little bit more. And but you know, they had two straightaways and a lot of turns and pretty interesting. I didn't recognize the drivers though. Anyway, they go around to different countries now. You know, they'll go to Japan, and now when they come to New York, they go to Brooklyn, which is pretty cool. Anyway, I'll start the SpaceNet report, Roy.
Yeah, sure, please.
NY2H. Yeah, Lou, go ahead. Yeah, can I insert a question at this optimum time, because we have Roy and we have Paul, and I'd like to address it to both of you. Okay, yeah, sure. Go ahead. We're here. So, I'm sure you're going to talk about Virgin Galactic and Richard Branson. And my question on what occurred today has to do with the weightlessness that they achieved. And this goes back to Roy's puzzle, where he said, you know, we're probably 90% affected by gravity at maybe those levels, or maybe even more at that level. And I don't think they're in a suborbit today, because that would have required an awful lot of velocity. So my feeling is, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, they did specific maneuvers, just like they do in the Vomit Comet, to achieve microgravity effect so that their passengers would get a taste of that, along with, I guess, seeing some darkness once if they got out of the limb. And instead of seeing blue, maybe they saw black, and then they came back down. They would have to make a concerted effort to have that microgravity. They'd have to have certain maneuvers. It's not built in or implicit, is that correct? And let me turn it over to Roy first, just so you guys don't double.
Okay, Lou. Yeah, it was my... I was doing a 10-meter net while this was going on, so I had the audio off and I was watching them. They had to be in some form of free fall. I don't know, because I didn't get the audio cues, whether they put themselves in some kind of parabolic descent or they had just reached their high point and were now diving down. But basically, they worked it like a elevator going very, very quickly down, as far as I could see.
Paul, you take it, and I'll be listening out. Okay, very good, Lou. Yeah, on the way up to, they hit an apogee of 52 miles, so that's definitely in what they consider space. NASA and the United States said anything over 50 miles is space. And the international community, they wanted to get up to 62 miles or 100 kilometers. But, you know, you get about 50 miles and there is virtually no air whatsoever to, if you have any kind of an airplane, no matter how big the wing is, it's not going to feel any kind of a force on it. So, you know, the only way you're going to move is with, you know, thrusters.
So they definitely are in space. And once they hit once the engine stops, and you know, the engine stops, you know, they're on the way up, but they're still going up because, you know, you know the engine stops, and you know, you just don't come to a grinding halt. Of course, you just keep on going. At that point, you start to feel zero G. And the reason for it is you're moving with the space plane at the exact same speed, and there's no molecules on the outside slowing the spacecraft down. You know, you're just traveling up. You know, you're going to start to slow down due to gravity, but so is the person inside. So you're going to be weightless on the way up. But at last, you know, I think they coast for about a minute going up. Let me drop it. And then they start to arc over. And when they arc over, and they start coming down, and it's like what Roy said, you know, it's in an elevator. The elevator is, again, you know, falling at the speed of the pull of gravity at that point. And so is the person inside. Again, there's no molecules slowing that vehicle down on the way down. So until they get down to, you know, they start to reach, you know, that third, maybe 30-mile height or 35-mile height, they start to pick up some atoms. And then hitting the space plane, and the space plane will start to slow down at that point. By that time, they better be buckled in their seatbelt. And then, that's why they say it gives them 3 or 4 minutes of free fall, where the comet, the Yavama comet, and now that, by the way, that's turned over to a private concern now. NASA used to do that, but yeah, they when that thing goes up, it just does parabolic arc. So you're just getting the zero G during those arcs, which lasts only about 30 seconds or so. They try to, on the way down, the jet is, they start to try to power it a little bit more to overcome the atmosphere. So they do get a little bit more than what you would just get during the top of the arc. You know, you're only going to get 30 seconds, and then they go back up again. They'll do this 4 or 5 times before they return. So, you know, you'll get a series of 30-minute zero Gs. So that's the big difference. Back to you, Lou, if you're still there. WS2R.
Okay. That sounds good. So it was, they added it for the sizzle. Yeah. Well, I guess if they're going to free fall, that's going to do it. And it's interesting. If you're falling at the gravity of 32 feet per second per second, you're free falling, no matter how you achieve that feat. And not only are you and the ship around you falling, but anything inside of you or around, you know, near you is doing the same thing. So in that frame, in that inertial frame, everything is, gravity is respected. The only problem is when you hit the Earth, that's the issue. We standing on Earth, I think, are the abnormal ones. Anyway, I'm being facetious. So, thank you very much for the explanation. And the vomit comment, I don't think I would last a minute. I'd be saying, yes, it is a vomit comment, because I can't even take rides, and I get sick. So, there you go. NY2H, back to net.
When the ship started to decelerate so that it didn't smash itself, the gravity came back to the people sitting there.
Exactly.
Okay, very good. The bomber comment. I don't know. That looks like a lot of fun. I would have done that years ago. Now, by the way, Branson's no kid. He's 71 years old, so he's doing pretty good. I mean, he's done a lot of weird things. He flew across the ocean with Steve Fawcett in a balloon. I remember that in the early 80s. So he set a record for that. He's really into all those kinds of daredevil type of things. So yeah, you put a couple $1 billion in a daredevil's pocket, and they're going to come up with a space plane. What I found interesting is when it lands. I don't know if you looked at it closely. It lands on wheels, but the front wheel, it's got the axle arm coming down. But you can see the piece coming down from the front of the spacecraft. But, you don't have an axle on a wheel. You have a skid plate, and that's what they use for the nose, which I think is really good. I mean, NASA's used it before, and now even the Dream Tracer that they're going to come up with within a year or so, that's going to be sending cargo to the International Space Station. That looks like a small shuttle as well, and that also has the skid for the front wheel, and they just replace it. It just slides along the ground. It's pretty amazing. You would think, well, why don't they put a wheel there? Well, they don't have to. It's less weight, less worry about another tire blowing, and it works. But yeah. All right, well, I was going to talk about that later, but we'll might as well talk about it now. He went up with five other people today. It's late about an hour and a half because of the inclement weather early on, I guess due to the winds. But they did take off in the White Knight 2. White Knight 2 is a carrier jet with four engines, so each one has, 50,000-pound thrust engines attached to it, and they're able to take off, and they try to get up as high as they can. I guess they get to around 45,000 feet. They try to get to 50,000, but they didn't get that high. But it's high enough, and they just drop them like a bomb, and then he's got this hybrid rocket engine that ignites. And, it's basically a solid engine, a solid fuel engine. But it's fueled by liquid oxygen. They have a tank that feeds, that adds the oxygen to this solid fuel. It's almost like a wax type of fuel. And that's how they accelerate. By shutting down on the oxygen off, they could actually shut the engine down if they had to, or they could cut back on the oxygen and they could actually vary the speed a little bit. Where a regular solid motor rocket engine, they can't. If they ignited, a solid motor rocket usually is it's almost like aluminum fiber, mixed in with a nitric oxide type of stuff, all within that core. They have different solid fuels, but basically that's what it is. And you're not adding different oxygen to the system. It's one mixture all the way through. You light it off, and off you go, and you can't shut it down. That's a solid fuel rocket. So that. They had a lot of trouble developing this over the years, and it gave them some trouble. In fact, I think at one point it blew up. I think it killed one or two of their workers when they were testing it many years ago. But apparently they perfected it. This is the fourth flight of this particular spacecraft. The first one was was successful. Every time they go up, they have a pilot and a co-pilot. And then they, in this case, they had a crew of, they had a passenger list of six. I believe it will eventually have, you know, when it's in operation, it'll have a passenger group of eight. They'll always have the two pilots, pilot and co-pilot. And the pilot here, he's flown, this is his third time doing it. He's done two test flights. The co-pilot went up one other time with him, and so he's got now two flights on his belt. So they're officially astronauts. They talk about, oh, they're all going to get wings. You know, these guys already had their astronaut wings. They've done it before. One of the women in the back, Beth, I have a name here somewhere with you. She's an engineer for that company. Got to ride as the first passenger in a previous. Anyway, she has her wings already. So it was only the three. The fellow that was sitting behind, Branson, and then they had Branson himself, and then one of the women. She's a vice president, part of these companies that he's involved with. So those three got their wings. So not to be outdone, Jeff Bezos will try to do this 9 days from now. And anybody that listens to the net is probably familiar with what I've talked about with New Shepard. New Shepard is the rocket that Jeff Bezos will be flying. They've flown it, I think, around 13, 14 times so far, different versions of it. I think it's around the fourth one that they've built, and each one they improve on it. So he'll be doing that on a Tuesday. It'll be on the 52nd anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. So we'll have to watch for that. It'll be a Tuesday. And this one flies out of Texas. The one that flew today flies out of New Mexico on a place called Spaceport, New Mexico. Spaceport America is the name of it. Built in, I guess, 2006 they started it. They built this thing with a 3 mile runway, and you know, I think there's been a couple of hundred launches of small companies of rockets, suborbital flights from the spaceport. But Virgin Galactic liked it years ago, so they started paying rent a couple of years ago, and when they did their earlier test flights in California, Mojave Desert, but now they've moved to New Mexico on a permanent basis. There's a big building there, and you go there and you train for 7 days before you get on one of these planes and take off and make sure you hand over $250,000, because that's what it's going to cost. Anyway, the New Shepard with Jeff Bezos will be flying out of Van Horn, Texas, southeastern Texas, and that's where he's got his launch complex there, a landing pad, and the difference here is they'll be flying on a regular rocket. I mean, it looks like a regular rocket. It's got one engine, though, just like this thing had one engine. Jeff Bezos also has one engine, except it's not a solid engine. It's a liquid engine. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engine. So it's a real engine that pushes, I think, around 75,000 pounds of thrust. Think about it, that's what the Redstone rocket was when Alan Shepard first took his first 15-minute launch. He flew on a Redstone rocket in a Mercury spacecraft. And that was about the same thrust.
and he went up. I think he went up over 100 miles, so he, I think 110 miles, and then came back down and landed in the Atlantic Ocean. Now this one's going straight up. It's going to go past the common line of 62 miles with this liquid nitrogen, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. Go straight up with a crew of four. Jeff Bezos will be there. His brother Mike is he invited along. Wally Funk, a woman, 82 years old. She'll be the oldest person ever to actually make it to space at 82. If anybody was here last week, I told you she was part of the Mercury 13. Everybody knows the Mercury 7. Well, they were the first astronauts to be chosen by NASA to fly on the early Mercury flights. Well, it was also the Mercury 13 that, well, a bunch of women, and they thought that eventually they would be able to maybe get a chance to fly. And they went through all the same tests that the men went through. And 13 of them passed, and, you know, were ready to go if they ever wanted to pick them to go. They never, none of them ever went, none of, not one. And all these years have passed. They've all passed on, except for two of them. One of them has macular degeneration, so that, you know, she's out. But this lady, she was the youngest of the group. So Wally is his first name. She's going to go she's up in this thing, you know, at least one of them out of books. Have the original 13 gets to go to space. And along with another person, I don't know who it is, they paid $23 million to do it. And there's rumors that somebody, somebody from, used to be with Google or some, probably another billionaire or something, paid $23 or $28 million to get on this thing with these guys and take off. So I guess eventually we'll find out who it is. And it should be interesting. They've got these very large windows on this spacecraft. The this one stage rocket will take off, get up to, you know, close to 60 miles, shut down. The spacecraft will separate from this rocket, and the capsule will, you know, again, just keep going on this parabolic arc and start coming back down. And again, they'll get probably 3, 4, 5 minutes of zero G. I think a little longer because they're going to a higher altitude. Bezos went up to 53. Branson went up to 53. This guy's going to get up to at least 62, probably 65 miles up. So he'll get a little longer time, you know, on the way down anyway, to add to the amount of time for the feeling of zero G. They'll float around the cabin as well, these four people. And then bolt themselves back in, and on the way back down, eventually the they've got three big parachutes that are going to open up, and they'll come back and eventually land, and they'll be picked up. Not too far away from where they took off. The booster itself that took off, the you know, this whole thing is called the New Shepard, but the New Shepard booster will come back down, fall straight back down, tail first, and about, I don't know, it looks like about 15 seconds before they land, the booster reignites, legs open up, and it will land. They have a concrete landing pad there. So looking forward to that in 9 days, a little over 1 week. I guess, let's see, I could talk about it again next Sunday. We'll be we'll be saying next Tuesday. So we've got one more week to talk about Jeff Bezos. So that's the story with that. Any questions or comments about these two flights? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report.
Two. be yourself, Paul.
WB2BXL. Good evening, Frank.
Yeah, how are you? A couple of comments. First of all, as I understand it, the two definitions of space, one of the definitions of space, of the edge of space, is the point, as you said, where aerodynamic surfaces no longer work, or airfoils, I think is what they're called technically. And the other definition apparently has to do with the point where the lowest point at which satellites can reach in their orbit, or the lowest possible orbital perigee, where a satellite will still remain in orbit and not be sucked into the atmosphere immediately and burn up. And I believe that, maybe I have it backwards, but I believe that's the U.S. definition, which is actually lower than the international definition, which has to do with airfoils, because that's, I mean, it's possible I have it backwards. I'm not an expert on this. That's what I remember hearing. Go ahead.
Yeah, Frank, I always got them mixed up, too. You know, and actually, with all this going on, I solidified that in my mind, where, yeah, the 50-mile height is NASA and, the United States in general, you know, the Air Force, that's 50 miles. And then the 62-mile or 100-kilometer is from the International Aeronautical International Group. They come out of Switzerland. You know, that's what that group is headquartered. They actually started in 1905. They started keeping records, aeronautical records, all kinds of records. You know, from the Wright brothers on out. You know. And then they got involved with, you know, what's the proper height. And I believe you're right about the, although there was one Russian satellite that lasted in, I think it was in a 55-mile area. I think it lasted 2 or 3 days. So, you know, I guess if the sun's atmosphere is heating up the atmosphere, you know, it's going to be harder to keep a satellite in orbit. So, you know, maybe it was the atmosphere wasn't that hot that day, and they were able to keep it, a couple of orbits below the Kármán line. The Kármán line is, yeah, that's where Theodore Kármán, I think his name was, from, he came out of Hungary, came up with the Kármán line at 100 kilometers. So, yeah, he's, well known for a few other things, too. He set up some kind of a deal with round cylindrical structures, you know, if they're standing up in the wind. He came up with this theory that's named after him. And I think it's the Kármán Street or something. Anyway, it's wind. When it's blowing past, let's say, a tower, an exhaust tower, you know, if that tower was perfectly cylindrical all the way up, it would have this wind going around it, and it would create this vibration. I think it's 10 pulses per second. And, you know, next thing you know, you have vibration, and, you know, you don't want that. So the engineers have come a way of fixing that. They'll taper it. It'll be wider on the bottom and taper it all the way to the top. Or they could leave it like that. And sometimes you'll see this like track going around it, up, you know, riding up around the cylinder, actually, we really only need this track on one side. If you knew the wind was only going to come from one direction, ever. It'll just corkscrew all the way around. Sometimes you see it on antennas, too. You'll see an antenna with a spiral around it, and that's what that's all about. That comes from this guy, Carmen, so I guess he was well-liked in the physics world. And they kept that Carmen line at 62 miles, 100 kilometers up. And that's pretty much the story with that. Let's see if we missed anything. Back to you, Frank. Okay, we're not hearing you, Frank. But anyway, I hope that answers the question. We'll pause long enough later on to make sure Echo Link can get back in. So very good. There was on the International Space Station, Dragon disconnected or undocked from the International Space Station this week after being docked for. Well, a little over a month, month and a half or so. They brought up, 7,000 pounds worth of stuff to the space station. They have two ways of bringing it up. The pressurized stuff on the inside, they bring up space suits. They can bring up food, clothes, different gear that they might need, science experiments that are refrigerated or frozen. They have all that capability inside the Dragon vehicle. It stayed there, and then now it's undocked. They don't throw all the garbage and everything into it. That they save for the other cargo vehicles that are destructible, that burn up over the Pacific. This one doesn't. This Dragon is reusable. It's been up there before. So they do multiple flights with these cargo vehicles, as well as the crew vehicles now. They do the same thing. They refly them. Anyway, this cargo vehicle brought up the solar arrays, the first couple of sets of new solar arrays for the space station. I probably talked about, I don't know how many weeks in a row, resupplying the International Space Station with additional power going from, when they're done, they're going to go from a total of 160 kilowatts to around 205. So they're going to add new solar panels every now and then. They'll have another Dragon flight, bring up more of them. And that's cool. And the two hams that were out there, the astronauts, the ham radio operators, Kim Rowe and Tomas, successfully installed rollout solar arrays. They're called ROSAs, R-O-S-A, rollout solar arrays. They're not accordion. They roll out, and it's pretty amazing. They don't need a motor or anything to do that. So, that was all successfully done. Now that gives the Dragon a chance to come back home and do it all over again. And on the way back, they bring all kinds of other science equipment back and things that need to be frozen. They have freezes inside of the Dragon cargo vehicle. They bring it, I think it was around 3,000 or 4,000 pounds more stuff that scientists can't wait to get their hands on. So it came down and it was delayed a couple of days due to the hurricane that they had on near the Pacific. The original plans were to land in the Atlantic. It delayed a couple of days and landed in the Gulf of Mexico, which they've done before, near Tallahassee. So that was successful. It landed at night. I don't have any pictures of it, but they are pretty good. They land almost exactly. They have their own when I say they, SpaceX has their own boat that picks up the vehicles, the spacecraft, and they bring them back to be refurbished and relaunched. That's pretty good. Cygnus is also going to go up I think in a couple of days. Cygnus launches from Virginia, from Wallops Island, Virginia. So I'll be looking forward to I think that's I say a couple of days. I mean, roughly a little month or so. I think it's the second week of August. But they're getting ready. That'll bring up more cargo, probably another 7,000 pounds worth of stuff. And that will berth to the space station, not dock. A different method of connecting to the space station. When you berth to the space station, it gives you a bigger opening, around 53 inches, compared to the 1 meter or 39 inches that you would normally get with the docking of that Dragon is now doing. So Cygnus will be going up soon. So we'll look forward to that launch next month. There are three different launches I plan on following this month, which will be starting, well, actually, the day after Jeff Bezos goes up, was it? I think that would be Wednesday. There's going to be a launch from Russia, but NASA will televise it. It's a Proton rocket, that's their big heavy lift vehicle for now in Russia. Is going to launch the Nikau or Nukia. Anyway, they call it, in Russia they call it Nikau, Nauka, and that actually means science. If you were to put that through Google Translate, you would come up with science. It's their science lab, so it's as big as their. The service lab now, the Zesder, their original, that's their original living quarters that they comfortably have three people in. And this is as big as that. And they're going to have more CW and CQ, which are crew quarters, CQ. They're going to have more of them. So they'll be able to have at least three or four people on the Russian side. And they'll have a new docking port, and it'll be it's a big vehicle, another kitchen area, another bathroom. That'll have three permanent bathrooms now on the International Space Station, which is good. You have a bunch of people up there. Now you have, seven people on a regular basis now. Russia adds another one, they might have eight on a regular basis. So I'll be looking forward to that. That launch will be Wednesday, and then following a couple of days later on that Friday, they'll have an undocking on the space station, and it relates to this launch. There's the Piers. It's called the Piers module by Russia. It's attached to the space station right now on the nadir or Earth-facing port. And they need to get rid of the smaller Piers module to put this gigantic. Piers is only maybe 18 feet long, and this thing's being replaced by this 45-foot long module, this new one that's going up. So they need to get rid of Piers. What they did is one of the Progress vehicles that went up recently, after unloading it and everything, ready to leave, they did put some trash and everything on it. But the main goal of this Progress vehicle that went up is to, when it backs out, it's going to pull this other module with it, separate from the International Space Station. And then they'll deorbit that over the South Pacific, the two of them, the Progress ship and the Piers module, and that will be gone. And they use Piers for an airlock for doing Russian EVAs, and that will be gone, and that will be replaced by Nikal. And that docking of Nikal, hopefully that works. We'll follow on the 29th, the next Thursday. And, you know, these things have been connected for, you know, since, I guess, 2000. And hopefully when they disconnect everything is intact. You know how things are when you take things apart years later. If they're intact, they'll be in good shape for this new module. But if it's not, you know, I guess they'll have to, you know, have a plan B before they attach this thing to the International Space Station. So the, everybody thinks, okay, this space station is done. It's not. They keep adding stuff, little things here and there, once in a while, a big thing like this. So, it was supposed to launch probably 12 years ago. Russians ran out of money years ago. They, you know, their economy isn't all that great. But, I mean, they had the thing built that was actually a backup to the Zvezda, the one that's up there now, in case that they had a problem with that. But since they did it, they were going to use it for another module. And it was supposed to go up 12 years ago or so, and it never did. And time went by, and then all the piping and plumbing involved with the system had to be replaced. They only has a guarantee for a certain amount of time sitting on Earth. So that was all replaced after years, and they finally got this thing done, and it will be attached to the space station. Any questions or comments? WS2S.
WB2KWC.
Hi, Ken. How are you? Go ahead.
Okay. Doing fine. I had this silly thought. I was watching Richard Branson, and he was sitting there wearing these shades, and I was wondering how heavy they got when they were, pulling multiple Gs.
Okay. I saw the other passengers too had the same glasses on. So I guess as they're going up, you know, the sun is up there, so they probably didn't want their eyes to be affected by the sun as they were going up. I would guess that's the reason they had them on, and they didn't take them off. But they only got up to around, they said, 2.5 to 3 Gs. So if they weigh, 5 ounces, it's probably 15 ounces. So it's not going to feel like that much on your nose. Even a space shuttle got up to like 3.5 Gs. You know, I mean, you felt everything pushing on you. So if you weighed, 200 pounds, you now weigh 600 pounds, you know. So very hard to move, but you still move your arms forward, you know. The early astronauts used to test out up to 11 Gs, see if they could take it, you know, in case they ever had that problem. But, man flight, you'll see when any kind of man flight goes up, they go up, if you see a satellite launch, those things take off like a skyrocket, you know. They don't worry about the people, or they worry about the pressure that's put on all the electronics and everything. So they don't want an infinite amount of G's put on these things. So I guess 2.5 Gs. I guess Richard Branson weighs, he looks like maybe 180 pounds soaking wet. So you're probably just 2.5 times that, whatever their weight was. So I don't think it was a problem. They get up to 2,400 miles an hour. So 2,400, I think, was the max. which, believe it or not, it's not that fast. It's enough to get you up to a suborbital height and back down. When you go into orbit, you know, you don't worry so much about going up. As you go up, you know, but then you start going.